on the front line of freedom. You're listening to Hometown Heroes with Paul Leffler.
Welcome back to Hometown Heroes, visiting today with soon-to-be 93-year-old Elmer Wright of Clovis, California, originally from Riviera, Texas, down along the Gulf of Mexico. He moved west to California's San Joaquin Valley as a teenager. Maybe he worked on your car once upon a time on the west side of the San Joaquin Valley, or maybe you worked with him in his 20 years with the U.S. Postal Service. We've heard about how he joined the Marine Corps back in June of 1941, was aboard an oiler outside Pearl Harbor on December 7th, 1941, and when we left off, he had described the Battle of Tarawa. Not only was he part of the bombardment from his gun station on the battleship USS Colorado, he actually went ashore on that tiny atoll and provided security as the Japanese surrendered that land to the Americans. He even has a scar from a flesh wound on his arm from that assignment. But so many at Tarawa had it so much worse. This was a battle that saw nearly 1,700 Americans killed, over 2,100 wounded. And on the other side, even more severe, there were nearly 5,000 people there to begin with. Japanese soldiers, in addition to Japanese and Korean civilians who'd been hired to fortify that island. And after just 3 days, that three-day battle, only 17 Japanese soldiers and about 130 civilians were captured. The rest of those nearly 5,000 were all killed. Did it bother you at all to see the carnage, to see the dead Japanese? You just talked about them piled on a truck, to see the dead Marines in the surf.
I know there's a lot of them floating around water. I was thinking about how they're going to get them out, but the coxswain and everything, they had their boats and they loaded them and brought them in. Yeah, they're floating out there in the water. But Bull Halsey, he wanted the Marines to retreat, but Holland Smith told him Marines don't retreat. Now there's an old spook ship right at the end of the island there. It was loaded in machine guns. And that's where all the guys got killed, mostly. But I guess the second day, they found out where it's coming from, and man, they Navy coming, Navy bombers, and they blew that ship to pieces, just kept bombing it. But after that, we got troops on there, it just lasted 3 days, and it's all over.
Well, at any point during that battle for Tarawa, were you concerned that you might be a casualty, that something was going to happen to you?
I felt more secure aboard ship. And those guys on there, because I had a lot of friends I knew that. Two of them was, I got in the Marine Corps, they give you extra 10 days vacation. I never did get my 10 days. But they were on there, and I think one of them got killed. They were brothers. But man, that was a slaughter there. Actually, we shouldn't even had to take that island.
I'm just trying to understand. I'm trying to put myself in your shoes. I mean, you're just a kid still. Does that bother you at all? Does that affect the way you see your own future or the way you get on with the next day? Or were you just toughened up so much, you're so much of a leatherneck that it didn't bug you?
Well, it didn't bug me as much as I had a lot of fear for the guys that got killed. But now, we'd buried a bunch of them at sea there. We had a rifle team, but I don't know if they were sailors or Marines, what they were, but we had a firing team. We'd put a stretcher, two 5-inch shells in a stretcher, and lowered over the side and bury them at sea. We done that all day once. I don't know how many we buried there, but I think most of them were sailors. But on Tinian now down there, when we come back to Guam, we fired star shells. A lot of Japanese swimming from Saipan over Tinian. We kept that going all night long. But some Japanese officers convinced our officers that there wasn't very many troops on Tinian, but he was wrong. But 2nd, 4th Marines, I don't think they had any trouble at all on the other side of the island.
Right, but the side you're on, and this is late July 1944, you're on the USS Colorado. You've already participated in the bombardment of Saipan and Guam, and now you're at Tinian, famous, of course, as the launching point for the Enola Gay a year later. But as you're helping to capture this island in July of 1944, you are working on your gun emplacement, other guys blasting away with theirs. But you were a little closer to shore than usual, and your ship received some serious damage there.
Our ship got hit. I don't know why we was in there so close. Well, the machine gun fire, you could see it flash up out of this buck brush and stuff. We were firing machine guns there. We could have got out there 5 miles away from the island and with those heavy guns and battered that out. Yeah, there's a big battery in the way up on the ridge, come out of a cave, a tunnel. And we supposed to made a, troops made a fake landing on the side. We was on the north side, and the 4th and 2nd Marines is on the other side. We supposed to draw the enemy to our side, but we did all right. There were 7 barges there, And he sunk every one of those. Our ship, it just sat there, the clothes just go around. Starboard side all fire, then the port side. I don't know why the skipper kept doing that. Instead of trying to get away from them, get out of the line of fire, we could have been out there 10 miles still bummed that all.
And you were on a 20 millimeter the whole time?
Yeah, we had, the seven of us got killed on that. We had three guns there and 10 men there. I can name most of them. Platoon Sergeant Bunch, he was laying there on the gun tub. He was laying there at the end, something coming out of his throat, so he was dead. And on the gun I was on there, we had three men to a gun, and I had Narboard. We had one guy hanging in the harness. He got killed. He was laying there in the harness, still the gun sticking up in there. Then Narboard come down. He fell right on his stomach right in front of me. I was standing there, and I got pretty bad in my leg and back wounds. And Private Glass come and fell right over the top of him. He was mumbling something to me. I never could figure out what he was saying, but. And I seen blood come out of his mouth, and he gulped, and he died. And there was Sabinski at the other end, Corporal Sabinski. He had his whole leg shot off, and he was standing up on that one leg, praying, and still alive. And there was a couple of corpsmen come up there. And he bandaged my leg up, put a tourniquet around it and everything. And I said, I told him to take care of Sabinski first. I said, no, we can't help him. Later on, they load us in stretchers. They'd lowered down stretchers to the main deck. It was set up about 12, 14 feet below the main deck. Give me a good shot of morphine and take me down to the Marine quarters there and laid me down. Most all them guys was dead in there, laying there. And I says, boy, this can't happen to me. I thought maybe they'd take me for dead because I passed out from morphine, I guess. And when I woke up, I was on a hospital ship. I don't even remember them taking me off the ship even. And on there, the funny thing is, a Japanese corpsman. I thought I was on a Japanese ship there for a while. And I played like I wouldn't open my eyes. And finally, a Navy commander come in there, and he wanted to know I was in. The guy above me, he got stepped on a mine. Boy, his leg was that big around. He's a lieutenant. And so the commander talked to him. He says, try to keep him awake up there. Keep talking. He kept talking about the Keys College and all that. But he died that night. And we went on to New Caledonia. Mob 5 Naval Hospital there. And I was so bad, a couple guys come in to visit me that I was with on the ship there. They had minor injuries. One of them couldn't stand to even look at me. And I even attempted suicide. I couldn't figure out how to do it, and I got thinking, well, I'd take a sleeping pill. They'd put one up, put it on my pillow. I got about 7 or 8 of them. I saw them both, that knocked me out. And so finally, they pumped my stomach and come out, and the chaplain, he sat there and he took me out of the suicide stuff, and I really didn't want to come home. I didn't want people to see me like things are.
Wow. I can't tell you how much I appreciate your candor. You went through things that most people never will, and certainly none of us wants to, but you're really making this real for us and helping us understand not just what you went through, but what so many others did, and even today, the things our men and women in uniform are dealing with. You were on a roll there, and I didn't want to interrupt, but I do want to go back a little bit now. Obviously, you were in need of repair and healing, but your ship was too. You were on the USS Colorado, and this big battleship is in close to shore to shell Tinian, but the Colorado ended up taking 22 hits itself during this time, damaged badly enough that the ship would have to go back to the West Coast for repairs after that. And the Japanese, it seems, had a lot more firepower on that island than your leaders expected.
When that big gun come out of that mountain, they had a tunnel all the way through that mountain, its own tracks. Boy, they sure laid it on us.
When you saw those big shells coming your way, was that happening for a while before you yourself got wounded? Did you have time to...
When they started, we got hit right off. Two shells hit right amongst us, sir.
What happened to you? Where did you get hit? What did it feel like? How did you react to that?
Well, I was on the, mostly Sabinski standing there on one leg to help him, but they put a terminal around my leg. Then when they left, I felt my coveralls on fire and put my hand out covered with blood. That kind of bothered me a little bit. I couldn't put no tourniquet on my buttocks. So they finally got it and trapped me in that stretcher and lowered me down, and they gave me a lot of morphine. I passed out.
So a shell from that big 8-inch gun came in, just exploded, and you didn't know where you were hit.
No. I know my shoe was off my foot, but my leg and my back engine. They never even checked my back. They put a tank in until they got the rest of the guys, all the, they taking the dead ones the last, they're still laying up in the tub.
Was there any part of you that wasn't sure you were going to survive?
Yeah, and we, the ammunition box got on fire, and we had these 5 buckets of sand for incinerator bombs. They'd burn right through the deck. So I picked that up. That was after I was wounded, too, and I threw that at and covered that tank. And I put the fire out. I got a Bronze Star for it. And on the other side of the Marine put out, he was a kind of a yard bird. Nobody liked him very much. The colonel gave him a Silver Star. So I met this colonel out by Dobbins, California, a couple of years ago. And I asked him, how come I just get a Bronze Star? And the other guy got, oh, he saved more lives than you did. Yeah, there wasn't but three of them. Yeah, it was Jones and Olson and me. That was only three that lived on that. All the rest of them were killed.
Out of how many?
I think it's 11. Now, one of them was a Navy guy. He was an ensign. He was a kind of a lookout, him and Platoon Sergeant Bunch. Oh, Early was the one that was hanging in the harness of my gun there. I was the loader. We'd taken turns about handling the machine gun.
But when you got hit, you were actually on your 20-millimeter mount firing toward the shore?
Well, I wasn't known. I was a loader.
So you're loading shells, and all of a sudden everything explodes around you.
Man, that stopped everything. Oh, yeah, Sergeant Seeley. He had a deal about this high, you know, around the kind of protection. He jumped over that and hit the deck and broke his hip, and I think he died later on because he wasn't in New Caledonia when we got there.
You kind of just matter-of-factly said, well, you got the Bronze Star, and I know the other guy got the Silver Star, but I want to touch on what you did here because it's significant. Here you are, you're wounded, you're bleeding from who knows how many places, and you see that this ammunition box is on fire. And I'm guessing the implication is there that if that fire goes unchecked, there's a whole lot of stuff that
killed everything. Yeah, I threw that at it, put the fire, but they were just three of us all got saved there anyway.
But if
that fire had killed us all,
it would have exploded all these rounds of ammunition, and you all just would have been dead right there.
Yeah, they put some kind of coddling on these shells, but that fire was burning up about a foot high there.
What made you think of this sand? How did you even get that idea?
We had the buckets of sand sitting all for in case we got incinerator bombs, could put it out. We had one up there, and I didn't know what to do. I seen it there, and I said, this is on the shell. I grabbed that, and I still was standing on one leg. But up there, the fire went out, and I threw it in on the fire. And 20 millimeter, once while we were firing, I changed that rifle, the barrel, and it was bent. It was firing, but no shells coming out of it. It was lodging up inside the barrel. So I changed that barrel. Finally got it out, and it bent. It was so hot. But old Early, he was hanging in there. He was starting to be a lawyer. He's very educated. And he was the one that was doing the firing in that battle.
Well, you told us a little bit about your injuries and lying there and not knowing where you were. Then you woke up on a hospital ship. What kind of care did you receive, and how long did it take for you to recover from those wounds?
After we got aboard the hospital, he picked shrapnel on my buttocks and on my spine, right above my body, 2 pieces went on each side of my spinal. I remember the doctor says, boy, it was close for you. But then he went on New Caledonia there, and I attempted that suicide. But, man, I lost about 80 pounds. I looked like a skeleton. I told the chaplain to let my parents know that I was missing in action. He said he'd take care of it, but he didn't tell them that. But I finally pulled out of it. And we come back States another year and 9 months to hospital. My first son was born there, and I was married there, and I didn't think I was going to ever get out. And I worked out 7 to 7 in a wheelchair part-time after I got out as a checker, you know, checking the box on and off, 3 o'clock in the morning. And 8 o'clock, I'd go over and go to school. I went to school for about 5 years. So finally, I bought a GI Bill of Rights house right where I lived there in Oakland.
We've got to catch another break here, but I do want to follow up on a few things you shared there. I'm sure I'm not the only one listening here saying, okay, you were in the hospital in Oakland for nearly 2 years, but during that time you got married and became a father. People wouldn't expect that to be an easy thing to accomplish when you came home from the war so severely wounded. But we're going to get that story from Elmer Wright when Hometown Heroes continues right after this. If you are a World War II veteran and you have not been to the World War II Memorial in Washington, D.C., Honor Flight wants to take you there, free of charge. The sooner you submit an application, the sooner Honor Flight can get you to your memorial. In Kern County or the Central Coast, call Lily Marsh at 661-544-VETS. That's 661-544-VETS. Or go to honorflightkerncounty.org. For Fresno, Madera, Merced, Mariposa, Kings, or Tulare counties, check out CV Honor Flight, CV as in Central Valley, cvhonorflight.org, or call Al Perry at 559-970-9853. That's 559-970-9853. Maybe you're the son or daughter of a veteran and you'd like to go along as a guardian. There are applications for that too, and there are other ways you can help. Donations to Honor Flight are tax deductible. We all owe our freedom and liberty to the men and women who put their lives on the line for it. Let's all come together now behind Honor Flight and give our veterans one more tour with honor.